This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony. Anton Bruckner was so insecure about his humble origins and his status as an outsider in the cutthroat music world of Vienna that when anyone commented on or criticized one of his works, it sent him rushing back to the drawing board to revise it. But few criticisms hurt Bruckner more than when Hermann Levy, who was the court conductor in Munich, rejected his Eighth Symphony. Levy had conducted the world premiere of Wagner's Parsifal and had been one of Bruckner's champions. The composer referred to him as my artistic father. Levy was the first person to see the score of the Eighth, and when he sent it back, it sent Bruckner into a deep depression. He even contemplated suicide. The long-term effect of Levy's criticism was that Bruckner entered a period of what one of his biographers called revision mania. Between the end of 1887 and 1891, he rewrote five of his symphonies, including number 8, and the end result is that it's been extremely difficult to figure out what Bruckner meant to write. In the case of the Eighth, most performances today use an edition that finds the truth somewhere in the middle between the original version and the revisions. It may not be what Bruckner actually wrote, but it makes more sense as a piece of music and may be closer to what he originally intended. The first concert Bruckner ever attended featured Beethoven's Symphony No. 4, which begins in an air of mystery. This was highly unusual for a symphony of Beethoven's time, but it fascinated Bruckner and stuck with him. Six of his symphonies begin with a low hum that serves as either a launching pad for thematic fragments or the foundation of a soaring melody. But what Bruckner does in his Eighth Symphony is to combine both, setting up the first movement's structure with a melody that is clearly going to be huge, but breaking it up into phrases with hints of how those elements will combine eventually. This was one of the things that most confused audiences about Bruckner's symphonies. They aren't constructed with the sort of long, connected musical arguments that people were used to from, for instance, Beethoven or Brahms. Bruckner writes in huge thematic blocks that seem to stop and start randomly, but which all come together at the end. Those large blocks almost always work their way towards huge climaxes, at which point the next block begins, sometimes completely unrelated to the previous one, or seeming that way. Here, after the second big melody in the opening statement, Bruckner introduces a lyric violin melody. A sinister march that sounds very much like Mahler. The exposition ends with quiet restatements of the opening melody. The development takes both that theme and the lyric melody and wanders around from key to key, eventually landing with a bang. But a sudden pianissimo cuts into this climax. And leads to the coda, which Bruckner called a death watch. The second movement, Scherzo, begins aggressively. It's built on the rhythmic pulse of 2 plus 3, a pattern that Bruckner used in almost all of his symphonies. The trio functions as a very short, slow movement. Earlier in his life, Bruckner had declared that the harp does not belong in a symphony. Fortunately, he changed his mind. The scherzo returns, and after several false climaxes, the horn signals the push to the big finish. The third movement, Adagio, is the heart of Bruckner's Eighth Symphony. Like the first movement, the Adagio begins with a drawn-out melody that builds to a climax and then restarts. But the second time, it finishes in a different place. These are more of Bruckner's building blocks, only here they function as a kind of classical rondo. Each time the theme is repeated, it's slightly different. After the second time through, a new melody in the cellos is introduced by a celestial horn call. There are many beautiful and passionate melodies along the way. And after the fourth time through, Bruckner builds towards the movement's real climax, but with many false starts. Beginning very softly each time. When he finally arrives at the high point of the movement, he marks it with cymbals and triangle, the only time they appear in the whole symphony. This climax is followed by another heavenly sounding passage in the strings and harp, which leads to the coda. and the movement slowly disintegrates, crumbling into smaller and smaller components. The finale is all about tying up loose ends. Bruckner's biographer Robert Simpson wrote, "The best way to appreciate its grandeur, perhaps, is to imagine some great architect wandering in and about his own cathedral, sometimes stirred and even exhilarated, sometimes stock still in rapt thought." The rhythm of the opening theme keeps coming back, reminding us that it's the same rhythm as the opening of Beethoven's Ninth. Until it finally culminates in a great brass statement. That brass statement is the return of the movement's opening phrase, but then it suddenly drops to almost nothing. But the almost includes horns quietly restating the opening fanfare, with the strings playing what Robert Simpson called smoky figurations that burst into flame as the burning sun touches them. There's one final chorale, which restates the theme of the scherzo, and then Bruckner goes all the way back to the beginning of the symphony, combining the main themes of the first three movements into a grand finale. Robert Simpson had it right with his analogy of the architect wandering around his cathedral. Bruckner's symphonies are all symphonic cathedrals built for the glory of God and to stand the test of time. As the conductor Wilhelm Furtwängler said, Bruckner did not work for the present. In his art, he thought only of eternity, and he created for eternity. Bruckner is one of those geniuses who have appeared but seldom in the course of European history, whose destiny it was to render the transcendent real and to attract, even to compel, the element of the divine into our human world." End quote. This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony.